Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Veronique St. Pierre, control yourself, or I'll hit you over the head with my hammer.
Pelijah Patchnose, a hammer-yielding powerhouse. Pelijah is the eldest of seven sisters. In Thompson Highways, the Rez Sisters. In this instance, played by Tantu Cardinal at the Belfry Theatre in 2014. The Rez Sisters first came out in the early 1980s, and it's since been produced hundreds of times. It's widely accepted as the spark that set off Indigenous theatre in Canada. It opened the stage door to a generation of Indigenous actors and playwrights. Four decades later, Indigenous storytelling has taken center stage, captivating audiences across Turtle Island. Say Anin Bouju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Rise, Red River by Tara Bagan, Space Girl by Francis Concan, Open House by Drew Hayden Taylor. These are just a few of about a dozen Indigenous plays coming to a stage near you. It points to a shift in audience attention and appreciation for Indigenous storytelling. That interest, Rose Stella says, started with the Rez Sisters.
The Rez Sisters was a fun way to be introduced to our culture, and it grew from there.
And while interest in Indigenous plays grows, Ojibwe storyteller Drew Hayden Taylor says theater is in our blood.
Theater is the next logical progression of oral storytelling. It's just a little less static than sitting across a bonfire or a kitchen table.
Anishinaabe and Slovene playwright Francis Concan believes Indigenous artists are using the stage to create new ways of telling our stories.
I think having more and more Indigenous artists in creative theater spaces, in rehearsal rooms, in design capacities, directorial capacities, you're creating this whole new kind of theater that we've never seen before.
Plus, Nova Corshane broadens the circle by teaching the next generation to find their voices through theater.
We just keep seeing that positive representation and not necessarily having to be rooted in trauma or in healing. It can just be something lighthearted.
Today, Indigenous playwrights are creating stories in their own way. And guess what? Audiences love it. Indigenous theater in Canada goes back to the late 70s, and while Thompson Highway led the way, others like Daniel David Moses, Margot Kane, and Yvette Nolan soon followed. Back then, much of what was being shared on the stage was our trauma. But those stories are changing. We are laughing more, sharing our dances, songs, and teachings. So what's behind this rise in renaissance? Two playwrights join me to discuss the changing dynamics of Indigenous theater. Drew Hayden Taylor is a prolific contemporary storyteller from Curve Lake First Nation. As a playwright, he's written 23 plays at last count, leading to more than 100 productions in Canada, the U.S., and Europe. Francis Concan is an Anishinaabe Slovene playwright and a member of Kuchiching First Nation. She's written 5 plays, including Women of the Fur Trade. That hit play graced the Stratford Festival stage last summer and sold out when it premiered at the National Arts Centre in Ottawa. Currently, Francis is an assistant professor at the School of Creative Writing at the University of BC. Welcome to Unreserved. So great to speak to both of you.
Same here.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Okay, well, let's start with Drew. You started writing plays way back in the day, in 1989 and into the 90s, and, you know, currently with plays like Toronto at Joomer's Rock and Someday. What Indigenous experience did those early plays center on?
Well, for me, when I call myself a storyteller, a contemporary storyteller, I'm going by the fact that the only thing I had to draw from, because I didn't study theater, were the stories I grew up with. I grew up right across from my grandparents, and during the summer, several times a week, there'd be a huge bonfire. We'd be sitting around it. People would be telling stories, usually funny ones, and I would just hoover them up. And then, you know, decades later, when I had the opportunity to tell stories, I think that was my training. I think that's where I sort of learned to weave a good tale, create some interesting characters, and take the audience on a journey.
And what kind of stories were you focusing on? I know Toronto and Dreamers Rock was about young people, and Someday was about some trauma as well.
Well, yeah. Well, during the early years of what I call the contemporary Indigenous literary renaissance, the vast majority of the plays coming out of the First Nations community were usually dark, depressing, bleak, sad, and angry. All the characters were usually oppressed, depressed, or suppressed. And that makes sense, because when an oppressed people get their voice back, they're going to write about being oppressed. And I remember, I didn't know if I wanted to be a part of this, because there were other writers doing this much better than me. And then I happened to meet an elder from the Blood Reserve in Alberta, who told me that in his opinion for Native people, humor is the WD-40 of healing. And I heard that, and that worked so much for me. So from there, I decided to sort of gear myself towards humor, highlighting, celebrating the Indigenous sense of humor.
Mm. Let's go to Frances. You started writing in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Well, when you first started learning about the craft and then writing your own plays, what did you notice about the stories, you know, especially the stories about our people?
All of my early experiences of theater were really with commercial theater, usually American theater or British theater. It was often like big musicals or plays that were really, really broad and general and for kind of like any audience. And it wasn't until I started studying theater more intensely and more like purposefully that I started learning there were a lot more kinds of plays. There was a lot of different type of work happening. But in university, even at that level, the only play people would really recommend to me was The Rez Sisters. Over and over again, like every year, every class, people would be like, have you read The Rez Sisters? Do you know The Rez Sisters? Mm. And this was like not that long ago. This was like 2010 was when I graduated. So that was kind of the play that everyone knows and the touchstone for, I think, anyone who was thinking about Indigenous theater at the time. Could have been different in Toronto or something, but in Winnipeg, that was really what people knew. Was like a couple Thompson Highway plays, maybe a few other names, probably Drew, Ian Ross,
probably Drew.
Hopefully Drew.
That was really it. And you almost had to kind of go digging for the plays and go really seeking out all of these writers. I had to go to the US to like get my MFA because I just didn't kind of connect with any like teachers, professors in Canada at the time that wanted to like study and like help me study the things I wanted to study.
It's interesting that you mentioned The Rez Sisters by Thompson Highway, because that's often a play that everybody's familiar with. Drew, I saw you nodding when she mentioned that. Was that something that you also encountered, this idea, this limited knowledge of Indigenous plays?
Well, the interesting thing about Rez Sisters was I lived just down the street from where it premiered. And I remember talking with Thompson and Elaine Bomberg, who was the arts administrator. And when it premiered in, I think it was November 89, it was an unknown playwright in an unconventional theater location, the Native Canadian Center, an unknown theater company, Native Earth, an unknown cast, all these unknowns. And during the first week, Thompson and the arts administrator had to go out on the street and give away free tickets because nobody was coming. Nobody knew about Native theater, about Thompson whatsoever. But once the reviews came out and word of mouth got out, by the end of the run, it was standing room only. And this is an example of the progression, the explosion of Native theater. By then, it was established. This is where I started to make my entrance, and other writers began to make their entrance. So it was literally, I think Red Sisters can be counted as the big bang of Native theater.
Now, you said something interesting there. You said that it really, they had to give out tickets on the street to get people to come and see this play. So was it just a matter of getting the audience interested? I guess it's a chicken and egg question. Or was it, you know, people were writing the plays and not seeing them, or people going to see the plays, so then people were writing them?
Well, I mean, with Red Sisters, just nobody knew about it. And, you know, back then, you didn't wake up in the morning and say, gee, I wish somebody would create Native theater. I would go and see it. You know, the quality of the product had to be made apparent before the audience to come, right? If you build it, they will come. So Thompson and Red Sisters built it, and the audiences did come eventually.
Yeah. And back when you first started writing for the stage, what were, you know, the rules of playwriting, I put that in quotes, that you were expected to follow?
Well, back then, as I said, Native theater was darker, was dealing with 300 years of colonization, of residential school, of reserves, etc. So basically, when people went to see a Native play, they're made to squirm in their seat. They're asked uncomfortable questions. Native theater at that time pushed the envelope, right? Mm. And I came along and I was doing a lot of comedies, and a lot of my early stuff was dismissed because it did not ask uncomfortable questions. It celebrated rather than accused. As I said, it makes sense. There's a saying Thompson has: before the healing can take place, the poison must be exposed. So during those first years, the poison was being exposed. And then when I sort of entered the scene a few years later, I was ready to do my little bit for the healing.
Francis, what are some of the examples that you have, you know, seen, read from yourself or other playwrights that challenge that conventional, you know, idea that all we have is trauma?
I mean, it's such a great point that Drew makes, because I think a lot of the early plays that I was discovering once I started, you know, really researching theater and really taking it seriously, yeah, it was a lot of very serious, very important, very difficult plays that were plays that, like, they were so valuable, but they weren't plays I would necessarily want to see, mm-hmm. which, you know, is kind of unfortunate, because it's such an important topic, but I think my generation, I'm a millennial, so I'm not that young anymore, but I think there really is sort of this ongoing push towards joy and celebration and humor and comedy that we see, like, in our communities, but also just in, like, the world in general. I think the world is not a great place right now, and I think people are turning to comedy to, like, process things and deal with things, and also to, like, mm-hmm. get through things and, you know, step outside all of the pain and the trauma that we see.
Well, the interesting thing about comedy, right, is that comedy is commentary. Mm-hmm. Frequently within Indigenous humor, what we're laughing at, what the humor we're telling, is a reflection of the universe around us and our experiences. So we're not being funny for the sake of being funny. It is actually a reflection of our environment, and not everybody gets that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. We'll hear more from Francis Concan and Drew Hayden Taylor a little later in the show. But first, let's pull the curtains back a little more to find the backstory on our rise to the stage. The Rez Sisters was one of the first big plays to show audiences just how powerful and hilarious Indigenous theater can be. But Thompson and his play didn't just make way for playwrights. It made room for Indigenous actors, too. And the Center for Indigenous Theater has been there through it all. The Center got its start in 1974 and teaches acting, scene study, movement, and playwriting. At first, it was a summer program, but now offers 3 and 4 year theater training. Rose Stella, who is Tara Umara, is the artistic director. Rose, welcome to Unreserved.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much, Rosanna.
Rose, what can you tell us about those early years of Indigenous theater?
They were quite exciting. I know that when Gary Farmer talks about those days, because he was there at the beginning, working alongside Jim Buller, and I know that it was the beginning of so many great careers for a lot of Indigenous young people who were trying to find themselves and find a way towards healing as well.
And of course, John Buller is the man who founded the theater school, is that correct?
Yes, Jim Buller.
Jim Buller, sorry.
Yes, James Buller. James Buller really believed that the arts was going to regenerate healing in our people and bring our people to new heights so that they weren't trapped in their trauma, maybe, trapped in the place where colonialism had put us, so that we would rediscover, reignite our own true beings, our own true selves, and that it was the artistry that was going to help bring that forward.
But why theater? Why storytelling?
Because theater, it is storytelling, but it also can incorporate dance and movement in the most simplest ways, where all of those areas of creativity and also traditions can be reignited. Those old songs in the 70s, no one knew those songs. So it was also a way for those hidden songs to start getting generated again and shared. And the stories that were kind of hidden as well. Stories, the songs, even some dances.
So a real reclamation of Indigenous culture as a whole.
Yes. Yes.
What do we know about when it's, you know, this idea of using theater as a healing and a way to reclaim oral storytelling, songs, dances? When did we start seeing sort of those things turn into, like, now we're acting and we're seeing that develop, and now we're writing plays, you know, in particular like Thompson Highway, then Daniel David Moses, Marie Clement. Now we're playwrights. Now this is what we're doing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think even Thompson said that he became a playwright out of necessity. So he needed to write some plays because there were no plays. But the need for new plays that were about us, it was the 80s, and we were generating this healing in these performers, but no plays. We were starting to build artists, but there wasn't a platform yet for them. So that need was being answered by these artists who were taking a leap forward, putting their thoughts and dreams onto a page for other people to read and to act out. It's quite an exciting time. It was also happening in Canada, because Canadian playwriting really started in the 70s, and Indigenous playwriting took its place in the 80s.
I love that. And as these plays were being written and as these actors were fulfilling these roles, what kinds of opportunities were there outside of the center and outside of the community for Indigenous playwrights and actors in those early days, the 80s and the 90s?
Oh, there weren't a lot of opportunities at all. I think Native Earth was one of the only companies that was presenting Indigenous plays with Indigenous actors, and Dabajamajig was also another springboard for things happening. It was really exciting what was happening at in Wik'wamnon at that time. It started on the reserve. It was a very important company where training was happening, I think the Rez Sister started there. I think Someday started there. It really was an important company that was helping Indigenous people generate their writing, and actors were in that place too.
Who were watching these plays? Who was coming to see the plays?
I would say people who were curious, first of all, but then the curiosity turned into a really serious acknowledgement of how gifted the writing is, how gifted the actors are. It's good for people to be curious.
You say that with a certain tone, Rose.
Well, I love that people are curious, but I want things to grow beyond curiosity to real support and real acknowledgement of us as human beings and as artists and as people to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What happened? What shift saw that more Indigenous people in the industry and more audiences going to watch the plays and so on? Was there a moment?
Well, I wasn't there. So I'm thinking the moment was the Rez Sisters. People laughed and laughed.
Mm-hmm.
They cried a little. And the Rez Sisters was a fun way to be introduced to our culture. It wasn't a scary way to be introduced to our culture. So it was an invitation in the door. So I think that was it. And it grew from there, right? Someday happened and people got, oh, what's this? Your child was taken away from you. She was adopted. Because why? You know, all of the information that's in Someday, it introduced to non-Indigenous people some information about us that was really important to know. And then also introduced people to real actors who were Indigenous. And so it was a spectacular change that happened in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, this is a beautiful history. Of course, I'm learning as we're talking here. How did the Center for Indigenous Theater fit into this history?
Well, we're part of, because we're not the only place doing it, but we are specifically Indigenous based. But I think more and more Indigenous artists are being trained professionals. You know, Jennifer Podemski's latest production, Little Bird, most of her entire team is all Indigenous. That's remarkable. For us who are in the training world and we're going, look at this. Look at what Jennifer has done. And Jennifer is an alumni of CIT, and so is Darla Contois. And we have amazing alumni students. We're very proud of how our students have moved forward, either with careers in film and television and theater. But I also want to say that I'm very proud of our students who've just gone away from our training and just living their best life. I will say that a lot of students come here and they do not know what they want. But when they leave, they have self-worth. And that is one of the biggest gifts that I get back, is seeing students leave feeling self-love and self-worth. That's a success story for me.
Yeah. And, you know, off the stage and, you know, from behind the curtain, you have the audience. Is the audience experiencing Indigenous theater differently today than they did, say, you know, 10, 15 years ago, do you feel?
Oh, yes, because everyone is more educated. Our audiences are definitely more educated, at least in Toronto. I can't speak for what the audiences are like anywhere else, but people get educated and they start looking for us now. They start looking for our stories. And that's exciting.
What do you think the future of Indigenous theater will look like?
I think it's going to continue to meld dance and song in the theater. I think it's going to get more confident in doing that as our performers get more confident in their own sharing of their traditional ways. Because you don't have to share traditional dance in a traditional way. We have so many hip-hop dancers in our crew here, call them our crew. They're building themselves as actors, but they're beautiful dancers. Mm. So I'm excited to see what they do when they graduate with this meld of talents.
Me too. Sign me up. Moving to Toronto.
Come and see us, Rosanna. Come and visit.
Well, Rose, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom today.
Thank you, Rosanna. Bye.
Bye. Rose Della is the Artistic Director of the Center for Indigenous Theatre in Toronto. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild.
Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Indigenous plays are exploding on the scene right now. We counted 10 happening at major theaters across the country this spring. That presence is inspiring a whole new generation of Indigenous actors and playwrights. Nova Corshane is seeing the impact on youth in her community. She is Anishinaabe Kwe and the co-director at the Native Youth Theatre Program in Manitoba. Nova, welcome to Unreserved.
Thanks for having me.
What first drew you into theatre?
So my first experience with theatre was when I was in grade 12, so 17, 18 years old. And my sister and I were asked to be a part of a play that was about anime Atukosh. We missed the auditions, but we weren't even really asked to audition. They just asked us to show up in our powwow outfits, and we were sort of secondary to the story. At that point in my life, I didn't really understand the depth or the meaning behind the play of it being about a murdered woman anime who is a American Indian movement activist. And so that kind of kickstarted the rest of the art form for me in theater. And I eventually made my way back to theater later in life at Native Earth Performing Arts in downtown Toronto, where there was quite a bit of content that was re-triggering or re-traumatizing. So that's sort of been my story and my understanding of theater as a young person.
Given that experience that you had in high school with, you know, the drama teacher treating you secondary, even though this was a very important story about anime, many people would, you know, that would repel them. Was there a moment for you when you thought, no, we have to take over these stages, to pun intended, and tell our own stories?
For sure. So one of the biggest reasons that I'm in theater is because of my sister, Deborah Corshane. And she invited me to come to work at Native Earth Performing Art as an intern under Isaac Thomas's general manager. And there was a lot of content that had her feeling really down, and I had to witness that because she's just there calling cues and doing the lighting and doing the audio day in, day out. And I think that was really my big moment when I was like, oh, like we have our own stuff to deal with. Why are we doing this to each other while still knowing that we have to hold space? So it's a very complicated relationship, but those are definitely some of the themes and the ideas that we've had growing up and our connected experience. Yeah.
In having discussions with, you know, other playwrights, they often say that back, you know, in the early days of our storytelling on stage, there was lots of trauma, lots of darkness, as you had said, because that's, you know, I feel like it was like us working through our grief, right? Like there's depression and anger and sadness, and then acceptance, and then eventually there's joy. Did you find that that was sort of how it was going?
Yeah, I think that that's changing now. I think it's indicative of the healing that our communities are doing too. It's really important to have our kids come on and really share their experiences however it is. And we're not ones to dictate and not ones to say, oh, hey, that's too dark, or we'll still give them the space to work through it and heal.
Yeah. And what kinds of stories are you seeing now as, you know, this healing, as you say, is progressing?
I'm really happy to see comedy. I'm really happy to see how being humorous is, might be a little bit of a coping mechanism, but is also a very important way to shed a different light on darker themes and darker things and trauma.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Our elders will often say that you can't have trauma without laughter, right? You can't have tears without laughter. It's about balance. Do you find that that's the case with, you know, working with kids?
I think working with kids, so they're, we're going to say about 2 or 3 generations away from residential schools. While those impacts are still prominent, so many of our kids are still in foster care, I'm already seeing that shift within our kids, and that the action therapy that they talk about in classes, the cultural things that they do at school. And so that impacts the stories and their storytelling. For example, I think it was last year, Ashley Cook and Victoria Perry were 2 teachers for our Roots class, the youngest class that we have, ages 8 to 10. And they helped these kids develop a story, a futuristic story, which I thought was just adorable and amazing, called A Powwow in Space. And it was about a young robot who didn't want to be a part of the assembly line anymore. And then while he was sorting mail, found a flyer that said, come to this powwow in space. And so that's the journey of our young person going to that powwow and finding a Nibinabe Kwe, or a mermaid in space. And she danced and hypnotized people to do what she wanted to do. And so it was just a really fun, really forward way of thinking. And I think we want to see those kinds of things come out from our kids. And it's important to look back, but we can look forward.
That's beautiful. I want to go to that powwow.
It looked fun.
Let's talk a little more directly about the work you do. Tell me about the Native Youth Theater. How does it contribute to the kinds of stories that we are now seeing on stage?
Like, I love talking about the work prior to what Native Youth Theater was. It was the Aboriginal Arts Company that Kalumpa Bob, Tracy Nepenak, and Ryan Black had all really helped to develop and grow all this amazing Indigenous talent about, we'll say, 15 to 20 years ago. Some of those kids are grown-ups now, and they've been a part of our programming and helping and passing on their knowledge. And they're all in the industry. They've all been on national stages. I think that beacon's been lit by our predecessors, and now we're just keep handing it off. And so we just keep seeing that positive representation, not having stereotypes and not necessarily having to be rooted in trauma or in healing. It can just be something lighthearted, but because of intergenerational trauma, of course, we're always going to have those scenes and we're always going to deal with those. And we want to. It's just a fresh take and a really interesting way to see our kids develop their storytelling skills that way.
Yeah. What do you think it is about theater in particular that reaches these kids in a way other things might not?
I think it's for sure at the core of the storytelling, that creativity that they get to express. It's really important that they continue to develop those skills and move in that way. And I think theater speaks to those kids is really they get control of their storytelling.
Yes, that's the root, right? They are in control of their storytelling in all aspects of behind the curtain, in front of the curtain, on stage. And it certainly builds confidence and empowers them. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. And why do you think it's important for them to, you know, to have control of those stories and to be able to tell those stories and act them or write them or, you know, build props and all of that? Why is it important for them to control their own story?
I think that personal storytelling is really important for our kids to hear about that, because then they get to understand that storytelling isn't always like the beginning, the middle, the climax, the resolution, and the end. And so like really using those Indigenous storytelling tools are really good ways to like get their minds going and sort of break out of that Western way of thinking and Western way of storytelling where it has to be paced the right way and set up and formulaic. And so we've been introducing those kinds of concepts into how we tell stories.
I love the spark when, you know, a young person or any person really gets that, like, what? I have a story. I can tell my own story. I can do that. Like, I just love that, you know, like the flame.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's a dinosaur who's eating a chicken.
Or a powwow in space, right?
Like, yeah.
It's not something you would, like, yeah, well, that's the story I want to tell. Now, as we see this, you know, this shift or this reclamation of stages in our oral storytelling ways, like right across Turtle Island, we're seeing so many plays on major stages written by Indigenous people. What effect does this have on the Indigenous generation that's coming up?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily need to introduce script writing and script reading and even memorization, because I know our kids can be really hard on themselves. So what I like to do is sort of like build the story in a sequence of events and then let them take that sequence of events and insert their ideas and make their lines. And so we lean back on that improv concept. So now they're not, if they can't memorize or get off book because they have so many other commitments outside of school and what we do, that they're able to kind of embody the story. And so I think that's a really important part of that storytelling, is just getting that positive reinforcement. And then there's also the social aspect of our kids being able to connect with each other as creatives in a creative space. And a safe space.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you give to an Indigenous young person who wanted to take part in theater?
To keep building your own content. You don't have to share it with anybody. If you even just want to hop on your phone and practice telling a story that happened to you, do something like that. And then you're going to find people that connect with you in those ways. You can start making little groups. You can start getting creative, reaching out to some of the adults that do some of your programmings, and really make sure that those opportunities are there for you, because Manitoba Theatre for Young People also has outreach. And we just launched our Native Youth Theater Outreach, where I'm one of the educators that goes out and brings sort of a condensed version of Native Youth Theater. And we work on embodying stories and developing stories. And that way we're also offering that to communities that may not have access to drama.
So just do it, in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
Give it a try. Get on that stage. Get behind the curtain. Whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Nova, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Nova Corshane is Anishinaabe and the co-director of the Native Youth Theater Program in Winnipeg. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today we're talking about Theater Darling, with a little help from two playwrights that have productions running this spring. Drew Hayden Taylor's Open House premieres in Montreal next month, and Cottagers and Indians opens in Vernon, BC in May. Meanwhile, Frances Concan's Space Girl will reach audiences in Montreal, and people in Toronto can catch Women of the Fur Trade. That play follows Métis rebel leader Louis Riel's historical journey. Sort of. Frances tells his story through the eyes of three fictional women.
You know, I was just out of school when I started writing it, and people that were writing stories that were like really important to them and really tied to them were finding kind of their audience and their crowd and their voice. And so it was really encouraged by everyone that I find whatever my voice is. Mm-hmm. Through writing it, I think I really started to discover that voice. And the piece was very much like rooted in growing up in Manitoba and hearing how our history was taught, you know, this very important like movements of different rebellions that came to like a head to found an entire province, get like 20 minutes of class time when you're like 7 years old. That just really stood out to me because when I was a kid, I remember coming home from like our Manitoba Métis history class and telling my mom in the class we had to vote on like whether we thought Louis Riel was a hero or a traitor. And just because of the way it was taught, I had voted that he was a traitor. And my mom got really mad. So I like just remember that as a key like pivotal childhood moment that really kind of sparked an idea for something to write about that mattered to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've touched on this several times already, this idea of humor, and particularly when you're talking about Indigenous writers. Why is that important? Why is that an important part of Indigenous storytelling? Drew, let's go back to you.
I don't sit down and say it's important that I reflect the Indigenous humor. It's just there. Mm-hmm. I have been very fortunate to travel to over 150 First Nation communities. And in every community I've been to, I've been greeted with a laugh, a smile, and a joke. And it is just so integral to the Indigenous experience. And I think to write something that doesn't reflect the humor that I grew up with, most Native people grew up with, I think is then writing something that is not really that reflective of the First Nations community. And I don't even know what play, but I remember once a stage manager telling me with a two-act play that normally ran an hour and 45 minutes, when it had a predominantly First Nations audience, it increased to 1 hour, 53 minutes. There was like 8 minutes of Indigenous laughter in it, right? White people would laugh too. That's not, I'm not saying they didn't. But the Indigenous people enjoy, I could be a subconscious thing that I layer it more with Indigenous humor, but Native people just, they laugh more in terms of our theater when they know we're coming at it from an Indigenous perspective.
Yeah, Auntie Laughs Alone will take a good 10 minutes.
There you go.
And Frances, what about for you? Is humor something that's integral to you as a playwright or as an Indigenous person or both?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like what Drew said. It's very hard to, I think, separate that idea for me because I definitely didn't go into writing thinking I was going to write comedies. I don't really think about it that much. I don't think this is going to be so funny. Like, I'm never really sitting there thinking about that. But as I write, I discover the humor that's just coming out of characters, like what they do, how they act, And that's just organic to like a character more than anything. But I definitely think it comes a lot from like, yeah, growing up surrounded by family and hearing their jokes and their laughter and the way they tell a story and how it's interwoven. Like the comedy, the humor is so foundational in the stories that it's not like a separate thing you tack on. Like if you're writing TV or something, you might have a note that's like, yeah, let's like bump this joke up. Let's make this joke more. Like it,
or in television, they have 3 jokes a page, right?
Yeah. They're like, you need to hit this number of jokes. That's not really ever something I'm thinking about. Maybe in editing a little, but it just comes out. It's so like organic and natural to, I think, storytelling when you've grown up around people that have passed down like orally stories. I think that's where a lot of it comes from, is just like we hear it and it becomes part of the way we talk and the way we share our stories.
Do you think that it makes, a difficult or play more palatable, particularly to non-Indigenous audiences, as you said, Drew, sort of the WD-40 of the healing part?
Easily, easily. I mean, I've talked with other humorists about this, and the fact that if you're walking down the street and you see somebody standing at the side of the street yelling about the evils of the world angrily, you might stop for 3 seconds, listen, move on, just wanting to ignore them. But if you take that same message and wrap it in humor, they will stop, listen, laugh, and take it home with them and maybe share it at home. Mm. And so I firmly believe that you can explore, you can delve into topics that are serious as much with humor as you can with straight drama. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even more so, where you can get into a place with humor that you can't by having somebody yell at another person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At the beginning of our conversation, Drew, you mentioned this idea of the Indigenous Literary Renaissance.
Contemporary Indigenous Literary.
I forgot a word. Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a term I made up. You know, I sort of hearken it back to the mid 80s, where there had been a few books before then, other things like that popping up here or there. But with the mid 60s, there was this explosion of theater, starting with Thompson, with Lee Miracle, Jeanette Armstrong, all these things. Suddenly, within 5-10 years, it doubled, tripled, even quadrupled what had been out 10 years before. Basically, the dominant Canadian culture and population suddenly realized that there were Indigenous people who had stories to tell, and damn it, those stories were interesting, and that they thought maybe we should listen to these, because, you know, as we all know, we're preaching to the converted here, our writers are as talented, as innovative, as clever and creative as any writers from any other culture. And suddenly they're standing up and they're saying, this is our story, these are our stories, you should listen to them. And people started liking them. And suddenly there's this little explosion, big explosion of Indigenous literature.
Mm. Francis, we seem to be well into this, you know, Renaissance. Where do you think it is now compared to, you know, say 20 years ago?
How long ago was 20 years ago? 2004? My gosh.
Oh my God, like 40 years ago. Back in Drew's day. How about that?
40 years and 20 pounds ago.
So 1984, that's the year we're like caging for. I was not alive, but it's for like, in terms of 2004, I was alive, and I didn't know anything about Indigenous writers, I don't think. I would have been in high school, and I don't think anything was being taught in school. I felt like, from my perspective, things really, like 2012 to 2015 was a big game changer time for me, and I'm not sure why that stands out in my head, but I felt like when I moved to the US and came back to Canada a couple years later, I felt like the landscape had changed like dramatically. And I don't know if that's from like having a different perspective or if it really did change dramatically like that, but I felt like when I came back, suddenly people wanted those stories and wanted to hear these voices and see these people on stage.
Mm-hmm. More and more Indigenous writers are taking, you know, to playwriting as a way to tell story. Why do you think that is? Why are more Indigenous plays and Indigenous people writing plays differently today than before? Drew?
Well, I think theater is the next logical progression of oral storytelling. It's taking the audience on a journey using your imagination, your body, your voice. It's just a little less static than sitting across a bonfire or a kitchen table.
And Francis, what do you think about that? Why are more plays being written by Indigenous people than ever before, it would seem?
I think Drew's point is really it. Theater is, at its core, theater, you know, it's really just like, all you need is one performer and one audience member, and then you have a play, basically. That's what I always tell my students. And everything else is just a beautiful creative extra, really. And as someone who loves the extra, I can completely see just how the progression between how traditional stories were told orally around a campfire, how knowledge was passed down from generation to generation. Theater kind of upholds that path in a really interesting way, especially when a lot of people feel really disconnected, I think, from community and from, like, how many times do we get to sit around campfires these days? It's not as often as I would like, but I see a lot of theater, which is sort of, yeah, my campfire. It's where I find my community, find my people, find stories that are, like, moving to me and important to me.
And as we see more, you know, more of these plays, hopefully, assuming that there will be more, as we see more of these plays being written, why do you think it's important for Indigenous people to tell these stories themselves in their own way? Francis?
Well, I think something about theater that really benefits from having the right people in the room is that it is so collaborative, and theater is ultimately a group of people coming together to create something together. And when you don't have the storyteller in the room, I think that story can become really misshapen and mistold. And having the writers, having Indigenous playwrights, having Indigenous artists in general in these spaces kind of ensures that the stories are getting told in the proper ways, the appropriate ways, the way a writer wants the story to be told. And I think that is really important, but also really special. Like, as someone who's a theater nerd, I think having more and more Indigenous artists in creative theater spaces, in rehearsal rooms, in design capacities, directorial capacities, you're creating this whole new kind of theater that we've never seen before. And it's so exciting.
And Drew, what about for you? Look into your crystal ball and tell me what you think the theater landscape will look like for Indigenous playwrights in decades from now.
I look at that like I look at prose writing, right? Both of them, as we've just discussed, dealt with the darker aspect of Indigenous existence and history. But within the last 15, 20 years, I guess more in Francis's era than my era, there has been this exploration of genre fiction by Indigenous authors. Right now, the hot thing is science fiction, Indigenous science fiction, but there's been Indigenous musicals and I wrote a vampire novel, I did a horror novel, etc. And now more and more people are doing Indigenous comedies. So I think in the next 10, 20, 30 years, everything that we've seen on main stage is in Toronto, Broadway, whatever, will definitely there'll be Indigenous, not versions of, but theater influenced by those different ways of telling stories and those different stories to be told. So it won't all be residential schools or racism or abuse. There'll be stuff about more positive stuff that's allowed us to survive those darker aspects and are more of a broader reflection of the many, many, many different facets that are Indigenous culture, good and bad.
Well, that's amazing. I look forward to staying alive for another 100 years.
Fingers, toes, and kidneys crossed.
Drew, thank you so much for your knowledge today.
As we say in my reserve, grazie.
Francis, thank you so much for your time today.
As we say on my reserve, I think we just say thank you.
As they say on my reserve, okay, boy, settle down.
All right, then.
Kaden. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Drew Hayden Taylor is a contemporary storyteller from Curve Lake First Nation. Frances Concan is an Anishinaabe Slovene playwright and a member of Kuchiching First Nation. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Laura Bone-Stubick, Daniel Piper, Rhiannon Johnson, and Elena Hudgens-Lyle. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginaskinamitinawa. Agosay.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.